But in reality, Judaism is supposed to be filled with love and joy, and life and text should be that way. The other interesting facet of Hasidic learning, which is probably the reason I like it the most, is that the basic approach to text for most commentators is either to understand the basic simple meaning of the Torah, which we call the Pshat, or to pull some things out of it that might give us deeper understanding. So, for instance, in this week's Torah portion, we learn about a guy called a Nazir who takes a vow and refuses to cut his hair and refuses to drink alcohol, right? And the question that our classic medieval commentators and Talmudic commentators would ask on something like that is, why would he take a vow like this? And the answer is, from many of the commentators, if a guy has problem holding his alcohol and behaving when he drinks alcohol, then perhaps he would then take a vow to not drink alcohol anymore, right? The text doesn't say why a person takes a Nazirite vow, but we intuit that from guys like Rashi, who was in the 1100s in France, and so on. The Hasidic take is a different one. The Hasidic take doesn't ask the question, for instance, with regard to Joseph, what did Joseph feel experience when he was thrown in a pit? Or why did Joseph react the way he did when he met Osnat, right? Or another one would be, you know, Abraham is talking to Isaac as they're going up the mountain and says, you know, God will show us, you know, what will be to come, essentially. And we're kind of trying to understand, like, why is Abraham taking Isaac up the mountain, and what is going to happen next, and does Abraham plan to kill him or does he not, right? We're very in situ. We're trying very much to figure out, like, what the characters are doing in the story and what's going on. The Hasidic question is, what is the experience of Abraham or Isaac mean to me? What is the personal, emotional parallel between me and Abraham, between me and Isaac, between me and Rachel? For the latter four books of the Torah, in which the characters and the stories are less important and the laws become more important, it becomes more metaphorical. And especially when you deal with lots of things in, especially Leviticus, where you're dealing with texts that deal with sacrifices temple ritual and physical items in the temple. None of those things exist anymore. We don't have a temple. We don't have the items that were in the temple. We don't give the sacrifices in the temple. So the question is, why bother to read the Torah at all if we're not going to build, you know, another menorah, if we're not going to reconstruct the third temple? And the answer that Hasidim would give it is, the Torah has meaning for all time's sake. The Torah has personal meaning. And if we were to believe that a divine being gave us a book, and that divine being was only meant to be read literally, right? Build a menorah, shape it like this, use brass, yada, 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 then clearly we'd misunderstanding an all-powerful, non-corporeal being who controlled the universe and dictates every moment in our lives, right? If God can, you know, create a beautiful flower, if God can split trees in two with lightning, if God can create hurricanes and earthquakes, then certainly God can create metaphoric meanings for Torah, which are way deeper than the simple meaning. So that's kind of the basic principle of Hasidut. Hasidut has one other wonderful, amazing aspect to it that I truly love, which is this premise. Some of you may have learned at some point about Kabbalah. Kabbalah is mystical wisdom, mystical literature. And it basically, Kabbalah is all about basically saying, can we know God in a real way? Can we know what God is actually like? And most commentators would basically say, no, we can't know God. So just read Torah and you'll get some little hints and that's good enough. The Kabbalistic take is, yes, you can know God, because God created Torah and God created humans and we are created in the image of God, and therefore we have little fingerprints, little hints at what God was getting at. And so furthermore, the Kabbalists were deeply studied by the rabbis, especially of kind of Talmud and medieval period and later. And what they would say is, you know, Kabbalah is really complicated and really deep. You need to know a lot of Torah to understand it. It's probably not for the masses, right? It's really for the elites of the elites. If you're super expert and super brilliant and you know the whole Torah and a lot of the Talmud and all of the commentators, then maybe you can understand a little bit of Kabbalah if you really work hard. And the Hasidim said, no, Kabbalah is for the people, right? All Torah is for the people. Democratize it, make it public. There are no secrets here. We're going to share all the deep wisdom. And I love that. I think that partially because, you know, I'm a, you know, 1976 born American rabbi, democracy is in my marrow, right? Like the idea that it should be for everybody. You know, I often think of the REM album when I think about Chassidut. Their first big album was called Automatic for the People. And I always think Chassidut is for the people. For those of you who are of a younger set, Wu-Tang is for the children, Chassidut is for the people. Okay. Some of you got that. Most of you are like, what's Wu-Tang? That's fine. Don't worry about it. Okay. Google it later. There's a great documentary also on Showtime, I think. Anyways, we're moving on. We're going to look at some texts. Here's the way this is going to go. There are we're going to do three texts today. These are all from the class that I teach, which is called Life and Text. It's on Wednesdays, 12:15 over Zoom. You can find out about it on the Beth Shalom website. I don't work at Beth Shalom except for this one class. I'm kind of dilly-dallying about the entire Pittsburgh and Erie community. But when you see the source sheet, you'll also see the links there, and I will cut and paste them into the chat in a break. We're going to do like three texts, which is ambitious. In an hour, I usually get through two and then hurry really quickly through the last one. So if we don't get to the last one, you know, I'll speed read it for you. So the plan is this. I've given you my intro to Chassidut. We're going to take about 10, 11 minutes to learn the first text. Then we'll open it up for some Q&A. Michal will open up will unmute people, but you can also unmute yourselves in about 10 minutes. If you have a question, you can also throw it in the chat, and hopefully I'll look at it. And if I don't, someone can slap me in the head and say, look in the chat. But we can you can kind of ask questions if you have any. Or, you know, this is like free fire zone. If you have a thought, if you have a concern or a thought, that'd be great. This is a class that, to some degree, I've been teaching for anywhere between 3 and 6 years. I find a text on the weekly Parsha or a holiday, and I bring it. I've been learning it. I see a couple friends in the room. I've been learning it with a number of people in the Beth Shalom community here in Pittsburgh. Last year, I taught it at CDS. The year before that, I taught it in my previous home of Denver, Colorado. And I also learn it once a week with one of our former amazing Pittsburgh rabbis who is now in Florida, and that's Rabbi Mike Werbo. Hi, Mike. Everyone wave to Mike. And hi, Melissa. Say hello to Melissa. Mike used to be my roommate in rabbinical school. Fun fact. You can now win at a Jeopardy on Pittsburgh rabbis who have lived together. Okay. So we're going to take about 10 minutes to look at this text and then open it up. The last thing I was going to say. The cool thing about this class for me was that it was no effort at all to put together. The hard part about this class was picking what to pick, which is that I've taught, I don't know, like 150, maybe 200 different texts on these parshas. And it was basically like, well, which one do I pick? I had one off the bat. The first one we're going to do was so good. I was like, we're doing that one. There's no question. It's really amazing. The second one was just a one that I really liked from a couple weeks ago. And the third one was the one I taught this morning. So, and they're all from different books of the Torah. They are not about Sinai, but all of the Torah was given at Sinai. And I feel like one of the default positions that often occurs on Shavuot is rabbis feel hidebound to teach about the theophany at Sinai and the giving of the Torah. And I'm like, you know, I'm sure your 9 o'clock did that, and I'm sure your 11 o'clock will do that, and that is great, and they are amazing. By the way, the shiur that I went to at 9 o'clock was amazing, incredible. So I bless us all that we get that good Sinai Torah somewhere, but it ain't going to be here. Okay, so with that, I'm going to share a screen. We're going to take a look at the text. Great. Okay, you should be looking at the bottom of the text, because I forgot to scroll. Yeah. Trying to get it big enough. The complaint that everybody always has. I've been teaching Zoom classes, obviously, like many of you who've been in quarantine for the last couple weeks. The complaint that everybody always has is, Rabbi, can you make the screen bigger? And the answer is, yes. Yes, I can. I'm going to, before we go any further, cut and paste this. I learned the easy, hard way that in Zoom, if you join late, you can't see any messages from earlier. So here's all of my flagrant self-advertisement. One is, if you'd like to see this, if you'd like this document offline, or if you'd like to print it, you can click the link at the top and print or view it on your phone or on your computer if you don't want to look at two things on a screen. The second thing is, if you'd like to sign up to join the Google group for the Life and Text class on Wednesdays and get more Hasidut, many of you are going to reserve this to see whether this class is any good. I understand. The second link will get you there, and you can sign up and we'll send you the emails. The third one, I've created a folder full of nifty information. Some of it is links about some of the rabbis that we talk about in Hasidut. Some of it is basic Kabbalistic understanding. One is a cool chart I made of all the generations of the Hasidim. And the fourth link on there is a straight link to the Zoom on Wednesdays if you wanted to join this class next time. So cut, paste all this stuff before it disappears into the cloud. All right, we are back to sharing screen, and we are back to doing some Hasidut. All right. Chassidut to soothe the quarantine soul, Shavuot 5780, with Rabbi Mark Asher Goodman. Okay, so the other thing that I have to self-promote, I know Michal's like horrified, like he's just self-promoting. That's not what we hired him for. They didn't hire me. So the other thing is I've been teaching each of these texts, and I've been writing an essay after each of the texts, and I'm slowly working my way towards writing a book. So at some point in the near future, a year or so from now, maybe there'll be a book of this. And you can say you were there for some of this, you know, when I launch my massive book tour that, you know, goes around the world and Justin Bieber wants a copy. Probably not. Okay. The first text is called The Bespoke Human. Bespoke, like, you know, a suit made just for the individual. So the questions, usually in our class, we do them at the beginning and we discuss them openly, and then we turn to the text. For you, for us today, these are going to be kind of guiding questions. So read them, ponder them, think about them as we go through the text. So the first question is, what does it mean to exist? What does the fact of our having been created mean in regards to our obligation to be grateful to the simple fact of existing? Or perhaps to the thing that created us. So contemplating how the concept of gratitude interacts with the idea of creation, but not just creation, but existence, right? Being in the world each and every day is the result of creation, but the two are not necessarily inextricably linked, right? You could be created and then continue to exist without pondering on your creation. And you could be created without ever having any moment to wonder what it is to exist, right? There are lots of animals in the world that probably have no deep thought about their own nature of existence, right? This is the kind of basis for existential philosophy of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. We exist, and therefore we must ponder what the essence of that existence is. Question number two, if we are truly created, quote, in the divine image, that means that each of us has the capability to ascend to the very highest spiritual level. How do we each go about achieving this? All right, so a huge idea in Kabbalah is the concept that God created us in the divine image, which means that we are as close to a mirror image, as close to identical to Hashem Yisborach, to God, as God's self, right? We are flesh and blood versions of the divine. Even, and this is where it gets tricky and difficult, even the worst human beings, even the most miserable, wretched souls, even the most evil, even someone who is consumed with anger, was created in the divine image. And what does that mean? What does it mean to have people who behave in a lowly manner because they've thrown away the potential of the divine? And what does it mean to be able to fully contemplate the ability for any human being at a low level, at a medium level, at a high level, however you want to categorize yourself, humbly or with great kavod, with great glory, to say you can get higher, you can get closer, you can be more like the divine, and there are methods and ways through study of Torah to elevate to that divine level. You know, there are Hasidic rabbis who basically say, like, you know, just, you know, there are levels that some people cannot ascend to. There are levels that are beyond, you know, mere mortals, right? And there is a Hasidic school that's short on democratization, that's a little bit more based on a concept of some people are just built closer to God or with more deeper capabilities in spirituality and Torah than others. And then there are other Hasidim who are like, nope, everybody has the exact equal capability because Hashem Yisborach created us all. The Lord our God created us in a way that mirrored us as being potentially in the divine image. All right, so let's get to the text. So this is based off of first chapter of Genesis, verse 27. Vayivra Elohim et ha'adam betzalmo, betzalem Elohim bara oto, zachar unekeva bara otam. One of the most classic, famous, deep lines in all of the Torah. And God created man in God's image. In the image of God, God created him. Male and female, God created them. So there's a lot going on in that line. We don't have time to really delve into the pshat of what it means too much. But the basics of it are that God has created man in the divine image. God has no physical, corporeal dimensions, right? That's one of the things that Rambam teaches us that we sing every Friday night in Yigdal. Ein lo demut haguf ve'eino guf. God has no body and there is no corporeality to Hashem Yisborach, to God. So what does it mean then for God to create man in God's image? It can't be a physical thing, because God has no image. So it must be qualitative. To that end, Kabbalah does a whole thing with the ten sfirot, and the ten sfirot mirror 10 divine attributes that God has. And some of those attributes are emotions and feelings that we learn in the Torah that God exhibits, right? God gets angry with Moses. Human beings get angry, right? These are ways in which we are created in the divine image. God gets angry, humans get angry. So that's a good place to start. So we're not going to do the Hebrew of this text, but I always give it to you so that you have it. A lot of this is from a series of books called, some of these are from a compendium called the Minashel Torah, Iturei Torah, which is kind of a greatest hits of Hasidic and non-Hasidic sources. I will give you a mild warning, spoiler alert or caveat emptor, buyer beware. I call this Hasidut for the Quarantine Soul. I'm using Hasidut in a slightly enlarged definition, in the sense that the first Rebbe we're going to look at is not strictly Hasidisha. Hasidim are kind of like strictly in one group, and this is going to be a text by the Altar of Slobodka. The Altar of Slobodka was from Lithuania. Many people would say Litvish Torah is not Hasidic Torah, right? That this is, you know, followers of the Vilna Gaon, that the rabbis in Lithuania were a lot stricter, a lot more literalistic. But when you read this, you can't help but notice the imprint of Chassidut on it. It's full of love and joy and generosity and gratitude and humility. If this is not a Hasidic text, if the Altar of Slobodka is not a Chassid, he's stealing deeply from the Hasidim. And that's okay to say. A couple notes on the Altar of Slobodka. Lived in Lithuania. Slobodka is in Lithuania or near to Lithuania. And they were, Slobodka, the yeshiva of Slobodka was kind of at odds with the yeshiva at Brisk. And the yeshiva at Brisk is Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. His son, Joseph Soloveitchik, goes on to be the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, and is one of the great rabbis of the 20th century here in the United States. And Soloveitchik is so greatly regarded in the modern Orthodox world that he is referred to as the Rav. If you just say the Rav, everybody knows who you're talking about. Okay. So, the Altar of Slobodka takes this verse, Vayivra Elohim et Adam b'tzalmo, and God created man in God's image, and does this with it. And God created human in God's image. In the image of God, it was created. On this verse, in Torah, we cannot overlook or dismiss understanding it. We must seek every reflective and contemplative depth that exists within it. That while there is the existence of a physical manifestation of the divine, before our eyes there is a form of a divine body and a need for corporeality. But, meanwhile, hidden is the spiritual being, a dynamic creation, that this is an aspect of the Creator. Okay, so let's unpack a little bit of that. He takes apart some of the things I said. I say God has no physical dimensions. The Altar of Slobodka is disagreeing with me a little bit by saying we do have a physical manifestation of the divine. It's us. It's we, right? We are the physical manifestation of the divine. We are God's creation, and therefore we have that either in common with or that reflection of the divine. Okay. But hidden is the spiritual being. We don't exactly know what the spirit is. We can't see it with our own eyes. He continues. From this concept, it is forbidden for us to dismiss this understanding for a moment. This is like a big line of emphasis. It is the foundation of all the foundations of Torah Judaism. According to this Torah, humankind was designed to be a witness that testifies to the manifest reality of the divine in the universe. The creation must give testimony to its creator, not in speech and in action, but rather to the very fiber of its existence, in its innermost being, as well as in its outermost form. It is the testimony of humankind to elevate and to reach to the realm of the spiritual and the moral, that they must recognize and comprehend the image between themselves and their master. He continues, every human can reach the spiritual level, not just special individuals that are gifted. To every person, there are the sparks of the divine. Every human is able to merit the revealing of the divine in their soul. So I often talk in my class about bumper sticker Torah, stuff that's so good that you just feel like, and I always wind up tweeting these lines, but it's so good you just want to put it on a bumper sticker, or you want to write it on a note and stick it in your wallet for when you're not feeling very good. That whole bottom section for me is like that, right? Every human can reach the spiritual level, not just special individuals that are gifted. To every person there are sparks of the divine. So to back up a little bit, just to explain that concept, the sparks of the divine, many of you probably know this, but in case you're a little curious about what that line is, there's a concept in Kabbalah that God creates a universe and God takes a space and removes God's self in order to have room in the universe for existence, right? If God is everywhere, there had to be a place for the universe where God was not so that God could make it. So God makes a vessel. This is a basic idea in Lurianic Kabbalah. God makes a vessel. God pours the universe into the vessel. And that universe was so powerful it broke the vessel. And the shards of the universe were scattered everywhere as sparks of divine light. And when we do a mitzvah, when we do a good deed, we redeem that spark, that spiritual light. We call it tikkun olam, right? Or just lifting up of the shards. And that's what's kind of going on here, that to every person there are sparks of the divine. Those sparks of the original creation of the universe are in our neshamas. They're in our souls. And when we do good acts, when we mirror the divine in divine action in our world, we are elevating those sparks back up to the divine. We are revealing those shards. So let's back up to the second paragraph, because I kind of ran roughshod over it. So he does this really crazy thing. He says, from this concept, it is forbidden for us to dismiss this understanding for a moment. And I said, that's a big line of emphasis. And he also says at the beginning, also end emphasis, on this verse in Torah, we cannot overlook it or dismiss understanding it. The Altar of Sloboda has a hard time, to some degree, moving on from this line in the Torah. It's basically like, listen, I know that there's like 500,000 letters in the Torah, and there's like 50,000 words in the Torah. But the reality is, this is it, man. This is as good as it gets. This one blows my mind. We need to sit and dwell, and we cannot move past it. And he has this other line that's really intense, which I really, really liked, where he says, the creation must give testimony to its creator, not in speech but in action, but rather to the very fiber of its existence. Okay, so what's he doing here? He's saying, and God created human in God's image. In the image of God, it was created, right? So human beings were created in the divine image. And that is such a mind-blowing concept that the gratitude for being that close to God and to being that much like God is something that we need to be constantly, vigilantly, deeply immersed in as an act of gratitude at every moment of our lives. And that speech and action isn't even enough, but we need to basically wander around in our existence thinking about what it means to be created in God's image at the molecular level. Our very atoms are God's atoms, and God fashioned them expressly for us, right? There's a very famous text in Mishnah Sanhedrin which says that God stamped many coins from the same mold, and the mold is God, and yet each coin does not resemble its fellow, right? A human stamps coins, and all the coins come out identical. All the quarters are basically, they weigh the same amount. You put them in a soda machine. Before the quarantine, we used to go outside and we used to put money in machines and sodas would come out of them. They were called soda machines. Some of you remember that. But you put a quarter in a soda machine, and if it's off of balance, like by a tiny shtickle, like a quarter, a millisecond of an ounce, the quarter won't work. It'll drop to the thing. Humans make coins, and they all have to be exactly the same. God makes a mold. Every one of us is like God, and yet every single one of us is completely different. We are different shapes and sizes and colors, and our DNA is very different. But at the very fiber of our being, and I love that line, fiber of our being, from a guy who lived 100 years ago who didn't really know from DNA, but DNA is all about the fiber of our being too. The very fiber of our being is this existence that is divine in nature. I just love this text. I don't really know if there's more I can do with it than say what it is, what a gift it is to just spend a little bit of time while we're in quarantine, being reminded that our souls are directly from the divine. And we're having a rough time right now, all of us. And we should feel like this time for us is a place to reflect on the specialness of existence and the specialness of being alive. And even though it's kind of boring, and even though we miss our loved ones, there is some deepness and some specialness to each of us, and we are unique in this facet. All right, I'm going to take a break here to answer questions. If anybody has one, you can throw it into the chat. We'll take a few minutes. You can also just say, I like this text, or I don't like this text, or I don't understand this about this text. People are anxiously awaiting the next text. Don't worry, we'll get to all the texts. If you have a question on this one, it's really good. Some of you are like, Rabbi, move on. I'll teach you a great thing. I was a day school educator for 14 years, and I've been a religious school educator before that, so I have 17, if you count the rabbiing that I've been doing, I've got about 20 years of teaching under my belt. I'll tell you a thing I learned like 10 years ago, and I was blown away by this fact. In education, it's a standard practice that when you ask a question, you should wait 10 seconds for a response. And some of you are like, no, that's no big deal. But when you really sit and count in silence for 10 seconds, it is unbelievably, mind-blowingly, like, quiet. You have to be very, very patient to wait 10 seconds. I'll tell you one other thing from education, which I think is wonderful, which is also why discussion is so important. A study was once done that showed that 80% of what people remember from a class is what they said themselves. So when you get off this Zoom call or towards the end of this Zoom call, you should just repeat the words that come out of my mouth so that you remember them better. Okay, I'm kidding. Partially. All right, let's move on to the next text. It's hard, I know. Okay, the next text. Sharing screen with you guys. This one's from a different place. I think I like the physicality of this text. The last one was very frou-frou, very spiritual, very like touchy-feely. And this one is very visceral, and it's tangible. And in fact, in order to understand this text fully, I went onto YouTube and looked up how olive presses work, because it helped me to understand this text a little bit better. So a couple months ago when we were at the end of Exodus, we were in a section of Torah, Tetzaveh, that is actually typically pretty boring. It's not an easy section of Torah. It deals with a lot of like text that's not particularly relevant anymore about how to make the oil that we use for the lamps in the temple, right? Like, you know, this is like the IKEA instruction manual section of the Torah, of how to build stuff and how to use stuff. And for a lot of people, this is like, you know, not that interesting. But for some of our commentators, it's really good stuff. So who we're going to look at right now is a guy by the name of the Admor Rabbi Avram Bornstein of Sochachov. So Sochachov is, like many of these places, kind of eastern, southeastern Poland. Avram Bornstein was a student of Menachem Mendel of Kotsk, and also the Chidushei Harim. The Chidushei Harim was the first Gera Rebbe, the first rabbi of the Hasidic dynasty of Ger. So one thing that I kind of forgot to mention, which is important, but it'll come up with the third text, is the founder of Hasidism was a guy by the name of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. And Baal Shem Tov was a moniker he probably made up for himself, Master of the Good Name. And he was the guy who basically said, Hasidut is for the people, Judaism should be joyful, right? We should get away from the rote, boring doing of commandments and find joy and love in prayer. And we should also make text available to everyone and not assume only that rabbis can understand this, but rather Wu-Tang is for the children, Torah is for everybody, right? Everybody should have an opportunity to learn these things. So a couple generations later, you get Rabbi Avram Bornstein of Sochachov. He would have been three or four, probably four generations after the Baal Shem Tov. Okay. So the pshat of our text, the first line of our text is this. Ve'ata tetzaveh et b'nei Yisrael v'yichu elecha shemen zayit zach ketit lema'or laha'alot ner tamid. You shall further instruct the Israelites to bring you clear oil of beaten olives for lighting, for kindling lamps regularly. Okay, so the question to hold in your mind here, in what ways must we be ideologically unwavering? And in what ways must we be willing to compromise our strongly held beliefs? And then a parallel question to that, how does the bringing together of both, right, having the nature of being compromising versus having a nature of having firmly held beliefs that we never let go of, how does that aid us as complete persons, right? We all know people who are like, no, it's my way. It's always got to be this way, right? And they're very didactic. They're very like, it's got to be one way. And then there's other folks who are like, you know, they blow with the wind. They're very willing participants, but maybe they don't have any strongly held beliefs whatsoever. My wife once described a mutual friend of ours as she's so open-minded, her brains fall out of her head, right? Like a person who just has no strongly held beliefs and can be swayed in any one direction. Okay, so Rav Avram Borstein continues. He's going to riff on the words ketitz lema'or. Ketitz lema'or is beaten for lighting. Beaten for lighting, which is kind of an interesting phrase. So we're talking about how the olives are prepared in order to make the olive oil for the menorah. And he's going to get into a thing that there's, and for those of you who have olive oil at home, somewhere in a cabinet, you know about cold pressed, right? There's a couple ways to make olives. There's basically three-ish ways. One is this way in the Torah that you don't see anymore done, which is that you basically take sticks and you lightly beat the olives. And that first little drop of sweat that comes out of those first olives that are lightly beaten, you strip that off, and that's what we're talking about, is the lightest, clearest, sweetest olive oil you could possibly get. And it's such a difficult practice to hand beat individual olives to get the single drop that nobody does this anymore. The way it's really done, if you go online and you want to Google this, is you cold press the olives. You squish the olives out and you filter so that you don't get any olive pulp. You just get olive juice, aka olive oil. And that is what you get with that 100% extra virgin cold pressed olive oil. That it's squeezed very deeply, but there's no heat. And there's also a deep filtering process so that you don't get any olive pulp. And then there's this third possibility, which you actually get in the store, which is kind of like what you would get if you crush the olives and you beat the olives and you mash the olives, but you didn't filter it very carefully, which is you wouldn't get clear olive oil. You get greenish or you get blackish olive oil, but it would also have a lot of olive flavor. Because you'd be getting a lot of olive pulp in there, little chunky bits, right? Like it's the difference between smooth peanut butter and chunky peanut butter to some degree, okay? Actually, that's a terrible analogy. Forget I even said that. Okay, the Sochachov Rebbe is going to lay it down for us. He's going to explain a little bit here. The olives are pounded by a mortar and not grinded by millstones so that it should not contain sediment or pulp. And after one extracts the first drop, one can put it in a mill and grind it. The second oil is invalid for a menorah, but permitted for a meal offering. As it is said, beaten for lighting, ketit lema'or. But it does not say beaten for offerings, which is based on a Rashi in the Talmud, Menachot 86a. What is the meaning of this? The light of the candles on the menorah are a metaphor for the Torah. And the Torah requires that everything be refined without intermixing of the dregs. Just as the sediment befouls the clarity of the oil, so too materialism befouls the clarity of reason. And this befouling ultimately gives birth to error. Thus, in order to be worthy of the logic of Torah, a person needs to become separated from the material, from the sediment and the dregs. Thus it was commanded of us to use pure olive oil. There should be no sediment. All right, let's stop there and we'll get to the meal offerings next because I want to unpack this a little bit and just explain the simple meaning. What he's saying is this, Torah study, you got to be pure. You have to remove yourself from the world in order to learn Torah at a pure level. And the world, he speaks here of materiality, corporeality. That the more a person divorces themselves from money, 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 Ferraris, nice things in life, fine wine, right? Like the more a person says, I have all that I need and I'm happy in my life and I have God and I have joy and I have family and I can study in clarity, the better the Torah is, right? The more you can get rid of the dregs and get rid of the intermingling of the pulp of life, the better it is, the more clear one's Torah can be. Which is a really neat idea, that Torah study is predicated on an ability to extract the cleanest, clearest, most pristine drop, that we don't try and intermix it. And back to our question that we asked at the beginning, a man's got to have a code. It's from a movie somewhere, I forget which one. But the idea being, you got to have an internal kind of set of morals and principles, ideas that you are absolutely rock solid on, that you would never compromise on, right? I did my taxes today. Yay! My grandfather was an accountant, and my family would go to him every year, and they would say, they would kind of bite their nails, as everyone does when they do taxes, and they would say to Grandpa John, can I take a deduction for this? And Grandpa John would say, the IRS allows you to take a deduction up to $500 on that. Not $501. You will get audited, but $500. And he was a man of deep principle. You did not mess around. You did not cheat. You did not go $501. You kept to the letter of the law. He was an honest accountant, right? If you can believe that. He was a very honest man. It was either perhaps to a fault. A man's got to have a code. This is what we're talking about with the pure olive oil, right? Push aside the pulp. Don't let it adulterate your Torah. Keep it clean. Keep it pure. Wait. That's not where this text ends, because that seems like a fairly self-evident thing, right? Be a man of principle and purity and everything will be good. No. The text gets better. It says for this. Thus, it was commanded to use pure olive oil that there should be no sediment, and that's for the menorah. However, meal offerings, which is these cakes of fine flour that were also brought to the temple, which were brought for atonement, a little bit of pulp and sediment does not need to be distilled as such. For the person that needs to atone, the need still has not been cleaned of all the sediment. And thus, such as it is, it may be brought as an offering. This is amazing to me, right? You could very easily say a human being must be as pure as possible and one must live in absolute purity all the days of their life. That seems like a very self-evident religious Hasidic text. That's not what the text says. The text says, ketit lema'or, you should have beaten oil for the menorah, for Torah study. But you should also keep a little bit of, you know, pulpy, messy, schmutziness for your daily life, right? Life is schmutzy. There's no way around it. We make mistakes. We commit errors. And we bring those errors and those mistakes before God in the sense here of a meal offering, which is a really neat kind of idea, that it's imperfect and it's messy, and that's life. And so we have times in our lives where we're not really sure what we're doing. We're not exactly sure what the right way is. There are shades of gray. There are mistakes made. And that is human. And that is life. And that is also literally here to be brought up as an offering to God. Here he brings it as something that's an atonement offering. But I think for us, it can be just a daily offering for us. All right, the last text we're going to do, we're going to skip Q&A here. But I will finish on time at 10:50 and hang out in the chat if you don't want to go get coffee and cheesecake in the lobby. Remember last year we had coffee and cheesecake in a lobby? Lobbies were places where people met publicly. Okay, moving on. Final text we're doing. And that is next week's Torah portion. The threefold blessing. So in Parshat Naso, in number 6, we get the blessing, which you bless your children with on Friday night, which the Shaliach Tzibor, the prayer leader, would do in the repetition, which the Kohanim would do with duchening while they do the hands that say live long and prosper, but I'm not supposed to see that because it's under the talit and you don't see that. Okay, so that prayer is really interesting, and we're going to go back to our originator of Chassidut, the Baal Shem Tov, for this text, which is a kind of cool place to finish. So the Torah says, Yivarechecha Adonai v'yishmerecha, the Lord bless you and keep you. Ya'eronai pana velecha v'yichuneka. The Lord deal kindly and graciously with you. Yisa aronai pana velecha v'seim lecha shalom. The Lord bestow God's favor upon you and grant you peace. So, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, who lived between 1704 and 1772 in Poland, in the town of Medjibuj, explained thusly. So he's tying together, before we go any further, he's tying together two lines. Yivarechacha Adonai v'yishmerecha. Lord bless you. Third line, God should bestow God's favor and grant you peace. So the question is, why is blessing in the first line and peace in the third line? Is there a relationship between the two? So the Baal Shem Tov says this. So great is peace that we learn regarding vessels that it can hold blessing itself, which has the aspect and inward quality of protecting it in an outer chest. Okay, so he's now saying peace is a coating, is a chest, is a purse, is a box that protects blessing. And then he says another bumper sticker line, without peace, there is no value to any blessing. Such a great line. A parable. There was once a house filled with riches, silver and gold and all the treasures of royalty, but it poured forth such that the windows could not hold it. Of what benefit would it be to the owner of the wealth if everything were open to thieves and robbers in the night that could carry it away? Only if the house is whole, shalem, that's a pun on the word shalom, and protective from bandits, would the riches be safe for its owners. And it follows, without peace, the hand of every thief and swindler would manipulate every blessing which God showered upon Israel, both material and spiritual. So the Baal Shem Tov is making an interesting move, and his move is this. Why is there God giving us a blessing at the beginning, and why does God finish the threefold blessing, one of the most important lines in all of Torah, one of the few blessings God gives us in Torah? Why does God finish with peace? And the answer is, if you don't have peace, you've got nothing. You can't have blessing without peace. There's nothing to hold it, right? It's like the riches that spill out of the side of the doors of a house and thieves come and take it up. This is very literal, right? A person with $1 million who's living in a war zone, their money does them no good because the threat to their life is so severe that all the money in the world isn't going to help them. But it's also like a nice metaphor, right? When you're praying, when you're living, when you're in the world, you could be bestowed with many blessings. You could be rich. You could be healthy. You could be happy. You could be surrounded with luxury, opportunity, bounty, right? But if you're unsettled, if you don't know peace, if you are struggling in the world, if you're in a place of pain where everything is anxiety, it all means nothing, right? So to some degree, that's a nice place to finish talking about quarantine. You know, you can feel that this situation is a punishment or a prison. You can feel like the world around us is in flames and everything is falling apart. But you can also reflect on the great blessings that God has given us, or the great things that you have in your life, the things that are going well. And you can shut out the anxiety and come to a state of calm, of shalem, of wholeness, of peace, of acceptance, of recognition that we are where we are. And there are opportunities and goodnesses to come out of that. We take with us our peace, and hopefully it will bring us a sense of calm. We can find a sense of calm that exists in a place like we are in right now, which is undeniably difficult. I bless us all that we follow the words of the Baal Shem Tov, that we that God grant God's favor upon us and grant us peace, that we know peace, and if we don't know peace, that we go in seeking it so that all the other blessings of our life will fall into place. Amen. Thank you all. Chag Sameach, and enjoy the cheesecake.